March 21st, 2012. Our first item today is actually the fourth item on the agenda. It's Senate File 1650, Senator Nelson's State Agency Reorganization Study Requirement. Senator Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for allowing me to present Senate File 1650. I believe you have an amendment in your folders. Might someone be willing to offer the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like it to be?
Senator Lilly offers the A4 amendment.
Thank you.
Proceed, if you would.
All in favor?
I'm sorry. All those in favor of the A4 amendment, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Go ahead, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Today's hearing is a chance to explore issues around how to make Minnesota government work even better for its people. Our speaker today from IBM will share the company's point of view on how states should approach organizational consolidation and reorganization efforts. IBM has been a partner with the state and a good corporate citizen, and we look forward to their perspective derived from their work with governments and companies on how we can identify ways to reduce our costs. Minnesota has opportunities to use this proposed efficiency initiative as a way to not only save taxpayer dollars, but also to improve the quality of services delivered in our state. This initiative provides a chance to ask fundamental questions, such as what are the core agency activities? What services could be shared across agencies and departments at a lower cost? And, Mr. Chair, I think that area is of particular importance to you.
It certainly is.
And is there overlap and duplication? While we may have our policy differences on how the question of what our state funding priorities should be, I believe there's one area that we can find common ground, and that is a desire to be the best stewards of the tax dollars that we can. And that means ensuring that the appropriations provided by this legislature are used in the most efficient way to deliver services and public goods to our residents. By looking hard for operational improvements and thinking carefully about the design of agencies, this body can play an important role in driving real improvements in our government and in the lives of Minnesotans. I'm hopeful that today's hearing will help shed some light on how others have addressed similar challenges and how we should move forward with our own efforts to make Minnesota work better, at lower cost, and with better outcomes for our citizens. Mr. Chair, with that, I'd like to introduce my first testifier.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, and if you could say your name for the record, and please proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Howes.
And Mr. Chair, let me give you a little background
on
Mr. Howes. You know, I sat before this committee last year and talked about the ads on TV that I saw about building a smarter planet, and I think we've all seen those and wondered, why can't we build a smarter government? Let's use some of those analytic tools to build a smarter government. And this bill, Senate File 1650, is kind of like Analytics 2.0. It is looking at how we can perform our government services in a more strategic manner. Mr. Howes is a member of IBM's Global Business Services Public Sector Strategy and Innovation Practice. He's a leader in IBM's Smarter Planet and Smarter Government Initiative. He's worked closely with federal, state, and local governments, and he assists public sector clients with developing and implementing strategies to redesign how services are delivered and to overcome the challenges of transforming public agencies. He has a wide breadth of experience in the public sector as a consultant, project manager, and policy and communications advisor. And for those of us members, you'll be glad to know that he is not a stranger to the political process. He served as a senior staff of former Virginia Governor Mark Warner, now Senator Mark Warner, and has worked for the minority leader of the Virginia House of Delegates and as a legislative director for a member of Congress. So I tell you that just to let you know he has the background and the expertise in how to deliver services quicker and how to do so within a political environment. And with that, Mr. Howes.
All right.
Mr. House, welcome again. It's great to have you here. And we thank IBM and you for the business that you do in Minnesota. It's great to have you here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here today to provide IBM's point of view on how states should approach organizational consolidation and reorganization efforts. We do believe that Minnesota has an opportunity to use this efficiency initiative as a way not only to save taxpayer dollars, but also to improve the quality of service delivery in the state. And as you know, IBM has been a technology and services provider to commercial and government customers around the world for over a century now. So I'm honored to be here today to provide IBM's perspective. If you look at slide 3, and I believe everybody's got a slide to pack it with the information, that IBM's work and expertise in transformational change stems not only from the work we've done with our own clients, but from IBM's own near-death experience in the early 90s. And the process that we followed to come out of that transformation is similar to what we recommend to our clients. And it consists of several key areas: transformation of operational processes, transforming organizational design and human service structures, leveraging data and analytics is key to understanding the decisions and generating business cases, looking at the overall efficiency of the organization, and last but certainly not least is transforming the culture and the core principles of the organization. And again, that's very applicable, I think, to some of the challenges that the state faces. In IBM's case, simplicity became a key theme. We went from 155 data centers down to 12. We went from 31 separate IT networks to one, from hundreds of PC configurations down to 4. The result of that was IT spending that was reduced by over 30%, even with a significant increase in volume. And what these changes did was not only to save money, but also allowed IBM and the leadership to focus on strategic issues, resulting in repositioning of the company and both process and cost efficiencies. And we looked at not only the individual processes, but looked at the big picture, the end-to-end integration opportunities, and across the value chain, looking at purchasing, transportation, storage use, really across the entire enterprise. And at the heart of that is data-driven decision-making, so this notion of analytics and analytics 2.0, using analysis to inform the strategic operations, and also using analytics to monitor performance and make sure that the benefits that are promised on the front end are realized on the back end. We go to slide 4. Just a very quick overview, IBM strategy and transformation practice. A lot of folks think of hardware and software and think of IBM. Maybe think of the Watson program when we competed against Jeopardy recently. But it's actually, IBM's also one of the world's largest consulting companies and have made a significant push to infuse smarter government as part of its Smarter Cities initiatives. So I just wanted to give you a little background on IBM's consulting. If you look at slide 5, our experience stems not only from our internal transformation, but really from helping thousands of clients, both private and public sector, across a range of issues, whether it's identifying opportunities for savings as well as executing and implementing complex mergers across national boundaries, state boundaries, and that confront a range of issues. So moving on to slide 7, really sort of thinking about strategically about transformation. And one of the first questions that comes to mind is, you know, where do you even start? And that's the old proverbial, you know, how do you eat an elephant? You know, and it truly is sort of one bite at a time. And from our experience, there really are a couple of ways to look at transformation. You can look at the various activities. So in this case, sort of departments, healthcare, education.
Mr. Chair, excuse me one moment, sir. Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Goodwin.
It sounds like he's selling IBM services, and I thought we were talking about how we're going to deal with state contracts and the master contracts. And so I think we're off the subject here because we're not talking about IBM. We're talking about general state contracting process. So could we get back to the subject, please?
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. Please proceed. Okay.
So when you look at and think about transformation, you can look at the various activities in government, so healthcare, education, transportation, public safety. You can look at common or similar activities that stretch across all of those, human resources, IT, financial management, that are common to agencies. And then you can look at different categories, transforming organizational structures. Ideally, when you put those pieces together, you're able to look at what are some of the business model improvements that you can make, what are some of the ways to enhance service delivery, what are the core competencies that you want to particularly focus on, and then, again, using analytics and information to drive the decision-making process around transformational activities. And so what we found is that a strategic approach to looking at the questions around transformation can provide can help to sift through and provide some answers. If you look at slide 8, there are really two main areas that we look at in terms of capturing the benefits. We look at operational and look at overhead and support.
Mr. Chair, we're still not talking about the bill.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, we are talking about the bill. We are talking about how we can do what this bill asks for. And IBM is one company that provides these analytic services. There are many others as well. But I think for the committee to understand how it is that we can reorganize government, we do need to look at how has it been done and how can it be done and what, you know, it's kind of like putting feet to this bill. So I would ask for consideration to allow the testifier to continue.
Mr. Chair?
Senator
like
Goodwin,
respond.
Senator Nelson, Mr. House, if you could be as directed toward the bill as you can, be as brief and succinct as you can, we can get through your testimony and we can proceed rather than talking about and having a discussion about what you're talking about. Let's get to the point, do what you need to, so we can move on.
Okay. So moving very quickly here, two key areas, operational and then overhead and support. Not so much asking the question of what should agencies be doing, but what is required to meet those agency missions. And then looking at overhead and support, which are those functions that are supportive of the operational and mission requirements of a particular agency. Underlying all of that, you've got business process, technology, and organization structure. And so as you're looking at transformation opportunities, it's important to keep all of those in mind. If you look at slide 9, you know, again, a structured analysis of the agency component activities can help answer some of those questions. You know, what are sort of core and non-core? What is potential overlap with other agencies? And you can really break the agency work into specific component pieces. And sort of like a, use the analogy of a set of Legos, right? There's a set of building blocks, and some of these are common to across agencies, and some of them are specific to a particular agency. By identifying and understanding what those pieces are, you can begin to look at the commonalities across different agencies and where some of those opportunities may exist. You turn to slide 10. Again, from our experience, there are really five main steps in looking at merger or consolidation, whether, again, it's in the private sector or in the public sector. And the first two of those is really looking at what is the strategy, what are the opportunities, and how would you put something like this together. Step 3 is the integration planning, and then you get into step 4 and 5, transition, and then the implementation monitoring. I like to use the analogy, it's sort of like painting a house where 80% of the work is caulking and scraping, and it looks, you know, terrible. And then that's all the planning that you have to do on the front end in order to make something like this work well. When it finally comes off, if you've done that planning in the beginning, then you're in much better shape.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I'd like to ask you a question that directly relates to the bill. Can I do that? Would you like to respond?
Senator Goodwin.
You're telling me the results of what might happen if we pass this bill, I assume. I'm not sure because you're going off in a real different direction here. But what the bill actually does is that under a master contract, list of eligible contractors that can assist state agencies in using data and analytics has to be open to the other agencies. That's basically what this what this piece of legislation does. I think that's already the case, but I have some questions that are really directed right at the bill, so I would hope that we can get done with the IBM presentation, and please stick to the bill, if you would, please.
Mr. House.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin, it's always good to have information, and this committee has always allowed testifiers. I believe what he is giving to this bill is us some background of what would happen or could happen if this bill passes. And I, for one, appreciate the fact that he's willing to give his time to do that. I am always criticized when I'm in the chairman's position, and sometimes by you, that we don't allow enough testimony. And this is something new, and I believe it's important that we listen to what could happen. We've done this on every other bill, I believe, in this committee, of what could happen if we pass this out of committee. So I think the leniency that the chair is showing right now is okay. I mean, granted, we are on a time schedule, but I think he's almost done, and then we can get into the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one last comment. Then.
Senator Goodwin, just thank you. I appreciate your sentiments, and if we could just allow Mr. Howes to finish. I think he's got two more slides, and then we can get into this. Mr. Howes, please be brief.
Okay. So I'll skip past slide 11 there, talking about two of the five steps. An example in slide 12 of looking at a county, a large county, where we sort of the same approach. You look at the some of the productivity measures. You look across the organization. You identify using analytics what some of the opportunities for savings and for improved service delivery are. And this approach can deliver those sorts of that sort of insight and that policymakers can use to make decisions and agencies can use to make decisions about how to move forward. If you look at slide 13, so again, the steps, and I'll skip over this real quick, so additional on the merger process around the need to communicate effectively, move quickly, and manage change proactively. Slide 14 is another example. This one is a shared service example of the type of opportunities. So if you, in this case, it was taking 26 payroll processing centers into four government-wide shared services centers for the federal government. This was spanned the scope of everything from working at the IT side to organizational change and development to communications. And putting those pieces together allowed the client to save over $1 billion in cost savings and avoidance over 10 years. It's an example of the type of potential when you look at some of the opportunities here. And then lastly, on slide 15 here, we'll also encourage consideration of some of the following points that agency mergers and consolidations can be challenging. Certainly in the private sector, in the public sector, there's a mixed history around consolidation. Department of Homeland Security is one, 10 years later, where they're still working on it. But there have been some examples of success as well. Point two, mergers they're part of the political process. There are lots of stakeholders. Step point three there, that public sector mergers in particular often require enabling legislation and updates to the laws and the regulations. And that point four, not to look at mergers and consolidations necessarily as outcomes, but as steps towards achieving those outcomes, whether it's lower cost, whether it's improved service delivery, whatever those outcomes are. And that lastly, the merger process, it's an opportunity to not only change the organizational structure, but in doing so to really look at the business and service delivery models and the processes that underlies those. And that's really where the costs in organizations reside, is in those processes. So with that was the information we wanted to convey.
Mr. Chair.
There are a list of people that have requested to ask questions. I'm going to let Senator Nelson make a couple of comments, and then we'll get to your questions, members. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Just to just give you a little bit of background on the history of this, we've been working with the governor's staff on this, the administration department. You might recall last year that we did the Analytics 1.0 bill, which the governor signed into law with executive order, set up the master contract for different areas in government using analytics to perform them more efficiently. It is our understanding that this would just be one more area that could fall under that already existing master contract. So, as I said, we've been working with the admin on this. It's just one more additional way that we can use today's technology to help government deliver its services more quickly. And this committee and this legislature and our governor already set up the framework for this with the master contract process that was put into place last year.
Senator Nelson, the one concern that I have that I just want to put on the record is that we want to make sure that this process is open to any company that wants to compete, and that it's not just a single company whose three letters is on every page of this presentation. And so it might appear to be showing some favoritism to a single individual company, and we don't want to do that for sure, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, thank you for making that very clear. Certainly our government does not allow that type of favoritism at all, and any of the master contracts have to go through a bid process. So there is no, there could be no favoritism. It would be a bid process. We're just getting some information from one of the experts today.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And I'm going to go to the list of members who have questions. Senator Hayden was first on the list. If your question is still on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helped me jog my memory, Senator Nelson, about some of the things that we did last year, because I think, you know, kind of following a little bit along Senator Goodwin's kind of comments, I thought it was that there were presumptions of that government isn't delivering service efficiently and that merger is inevitable, and that IBM at some point came, you know, 20 years ago or 15 years ago when they were struggling and decided that they needed to kind of change their business model and merge their business operations and their data centers, and to kind of get back to where they are today, which is a industry leader. And so I think for me it started out with a question of, have we kind of had the discussion that we aren't delivering our services efficiently? And I do remember that we've had some conversation when I was in the House of State Gov that we had started that process of using analytics to see if we could be more efficient. And I can remember specifically thinking about it in the Department of Revenue to try to capture more revenue through analytics. And so I think part of what – so I'm tracking now. But part of what I think I would want to know, and maybe the Department of Administration could help us, is the outcomes and what happened based on the bill that we did last year. And so I think I see around here every once in a while we kind of get onto something and then we race. And I don't know if we always get the information from what we passed last year to then help us provide us to what we want to do in the years moving forward. And so I don't know if this is kind of if we're moving too fast, or if this is right the pace that we should be, or should we be moving even faster. And so I think that Senator Nelson, Mr. Chair, that would be helpful. And hopefully the Department of Administration can talk about that today as to where we are. And if we're seeing the kind of change that we were looking for out of Analytics 1.0, then maybe this is the right place to go. But it just seems like we're kind of rushing to kind of consolidate and make government more efficient, and without us, at least, you know, today, or maybe I'm missing something, understanding what we've done. The other thing that I think is important as we go to a more database, technology-based environment is we still deal with people. And we still deal with real people with real issues that aren't necessarily – that don't line up perfectly with the business world and the work that you guys do at IBM and other private businesses. And so I think I'd also like to hear from the testifier, so it looks like you've done some work with other governmental agencies. How did that work in terms of dealing with, you know, a Department of Human Services that might be delivering services to people who – aren't as efficient as they should be by the nature of why we have the department? So,
Senator Hayden, I'm glad there was a question in there. Thank you very much. Please proceed, Mr. House.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I think what we've seen in the public sector is, as I mentioned, that the process doesn't always necessarily work for the consumer, at the end user in this case, for the citizens. And so human services is a good example of that, where you can have processes that ping-pong people between agencies or within agencies, you can look at streamlining or redesigning those processes in such a way that you've got a single point of entry for a customer so that it actually speeds both the delivery of the service and gets them the services that they need quicker. So it's not just around what does it cost, but around how the services are delivered.
Senator Nelson, then we're going to have Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hayden, you also asked some very good questions prior, which I just wanted to touch base on. This is just calling for a study. We don't know if there would be a merger or consolidation. You don't know. It's really a premature question at this point. But this study would answer that question. We don't know. And then also you brought up a good point about let's get some results from what we've done already. And I believe those are coming in as we had intended, but we'll let somebody else speak to that. But I would like you to notice in the bill, actually the last few lines of the bill call for the very thing you're asking for, which is that a report be made back to the legislature in this regard. So I think that's a good comment and one we should keep in mind.
To that point, Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there somebody from admin here?
Good afternoon. Welcome. My name is Kurt Yoakum.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
My name is Kurt Yoakum. I'm the legislative liaison with the Department of Administration. In addition, I also have Kent Allen here, who is our chief procurement officer.
Thank you, Mr. Yoakum.
Senator Perry.
What I wanted to do was ask you, and the reason I felt that I wanted to hear more, the testimony that you heard today is similar to what you will have to go through as these companies would come to you and explain what they can do to help with any efficiencies. Because as I look at this, they're just another tool in the toolkit that we talked about last session that, as I recall, I don't believe I had one commissioner tell me that they didn't want another tool in the toolkit. So is that the type of information that you and the commissioner, your team, will get as you're making up your mind if this bill were to pass, to follow through with that?
Mr. Yoakum.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, why don't I answer that question by just taking one step back. Given some of the legislative efforts last year and the executive order, the Department of Administration did go through the master contract. We did prepare a legislative report that was turned into both the Senate and the House back in January. But as part of the starting, I believe it was in April or May, the RFP process went forward to develop the entire master contract with the with all the negotiations and the last signatures and contract signed, I believe, in mid to late December. And in that process, we developed both with what was in legislation and also with customer focus groups in the executive branch with multiple agencies participating. We developed a master contract that serves 12 different service categories. And within those 12 service categories, not each category does this number relate to, but there's about 22 vendors total that are qualified to participate in the various service categories that were listed. And actually, in working with the authors on this, on the amended version, we do feel that actually this type of work falls within the current master contract in at least one, if not multiple, of the categories. So this is the type of information that will be accessed by agencies. And the one thing that we would like to also remind the committee, and if I go too far on a limb here, I'll have Mr. Allen correct me, but when you talk about a master contract, we just wanted to clear that that's an overarching contract that it puts the qualified vendors in the different service categories, and then each agency can decide which categories might be most applicable or beneficial to them, and then engage the pre-approved vendors in there, and they can still go through a further negotiation process, so we don't have something just set up already in place, and telling each agency that they're going to do this. They're going to engage with what's the most appropriate to them and then look at the different vendors in those particular service categories and then go through a further negotiation process.
Thank you very much.
That answers your question.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Nelson, I just wanted to, if you indulge me, committee, just for a couple of minutes, I wanted to share a story with you. I happen to have a few years back when I worked for the Department of Human Services along with thousands of people, I believed very strongly that we could do business better. And I still think that way. I think that we could do business more efficiently in government, that government has become very compartments, have kind of divided and fractured relationships, and duplication exists. I think that this is not a bad idea. One thing that happened to me when I was really strongly thinking about this, the Carlson administration was in charge, and we had a Minnesota Planning Department, and we advocated for a review of children's programs. And we thought that what was happening in the state was insane because we had so many programs all over the place and no one knew what each other was doing, and that we needed to create a department that really knew about what was going on with kids, education, healthcare, corrections, whatever. And we succeeded. And actually, we got funding, and it was about $450,000 at that time. And we hired a company called Impact. We know, I mean, the government, whomever worked on this effort. And we hired this amazing group of consultants. The majority were women, very driven, very knowledgeable. And they put together a report that came to the administration and recommended that we move all of these agencies into one umbrella that became the Children's Services Department. That became legislation. It was, really...
What was it called? Children, Families, and Learning.
Mm-hmm. Children, Families, and Learning. That's correct. Mm-hmm. So it became that department, and I was part of that move. We moved and changed agencies, and it happened. And then the Ventura administration came and criticized that and changed a few things back. And then the Pawlenty administration really did not like that we did not have a Department of Education, and voila, we were all moved back to where we were before. All of that, it's a long story. Many, Senator Olson perhaps knows a lot about this story. So you went through it all. Yeah. I did too, but I was not a legislator. And actually, that was one of the reasons I got very motivated to run for office, because I thought that was insane. And actually, the reason I'm telling you this story is because I don't care if IBM give us $20 million tomorrow and they have the best consultants to come and tell us how to do business. The bottom line with us is that really, again and again, and this is the same thing about rules, we have to do this work. Legislators have to come together and really look at what is happening right now with these different departments, how we're doing our work, and little by little really change what we need to change. Unfortunately, Senator Nelson, that's not going to last, because if we leave, somebody's going to come and change what we did. So I don't want to sound so dramatic about this, but I just wanted to let you know that we have experienced this in the past, and what it takes is true commitment and really a political effort that is about the individuals that we serve, and we must do that. So I'm not against this piece of legislation. I'm telling you history. I don't know if history will repeat itself, but I think we need to sit down during the interim, look at what we have, change what we don't like, come and do it. That's I've been saying that for rules and for all the things that have been recommended here to pass time and time again. Let's let somebody study and tell us what to do. You can bring scientists to tell us what to do. If we politically are not inclined to respond, it's just not going to happen.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. Actually, I do remember some of that history dealing with the Department of Children, Families, and Learning, both as a teacher and then as a House member. So I do think, though, you make the point about why we need data-driven results, which is really what this study looks at. It's using today's tools, analytic tools, to get that data that is going to drive decision-making that we do need to make in this body. But making decisions without data is very dangerous, and it also leaves open this instance of change that we so often see because somebody else might have a different idea. So I believe that having data-driven results can help us as a legislature and help us make decisions that are long-lasting decisions so we don't repeat some of the concerns that you mentioned.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the challenges of that whole era and move was that, you know, we had to find a title that kind of encompassed everything, and it moved chunks of departments in under the umbrella of one, but the chunks all stayed the same. And, you know, sometimes it was driven by federal law or, you know, where the source of revenue was. It was very tough to meld or to start to look at who the end recipient of the service was and needed and what they needed and to let that guide how you created your structure. I don't know how we – if any of these consultants can help to do that. Part of the challenge on one of your slides, you know, the difficulty of merging or reorganizing, it is disruptive. It is disruptive because people are kind of entrenched in what they do and where they, you know, where and how they do it. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue to try. And if this would open doors to ideas, it is still behooves the legislature to make some of those kinds of decisions. We sit around here sometimes and we propose some of these things without knowing what is going on. And I think that's where some of the consultants that can get in, not only using the data, but probably can bring to fore things that ought to be a part of consideration of making some of these changes.
Members, I'm appreciating this very thoughtful discussion. Keeping in mind the other items that we have on today's agenda, we're getting very close to wrapping this one up. We have two more members that are going to ask questions, and then we're going to wrap it up. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Nelson, I've got an oral amendment here that I'd like to make to you, and I don't think this should be anything that's very controversial, but one of the things I found in state contracting, a lot of things I found in state contracting practices, which I studied for almost 20 years, and one of them is that the lack of oversight by state agencies of those contracts once they're let. So the other thing is on page 1.15, this is part of my amendment, where you have improvements in efficiency and effectiveness. I think that's kind of a value-laden word because that doesn't tell us if it's not efficient or not effective, and they wouldn't have to tell us that. So I would suggest taking out the words improvement in and just reading for the staff's sake.
Mr. Chairman, what are you working from?
I'm working from the delete all.
Members, we are on the A4 amendment.
Delete all.
Okay. The delete all amendment.
1.5. Okay, not okay. 1.5. All right.
1.15.
Yeah,
1.15. Almost 1. At 5. The bottom.
Right. So I would suggest deleting improvements in efficiency and effectiveness because we just need to find out if they're efficient and effective, not assuming that there's going to be improvements. And to make sure that that happens, because there's hardly any oversight over a number of these contracts, we end up paying state costs above and beyond what we would have ever spent and getting either no results or getting results that then staff has to go back and redo because they're not done appropriately or right. And so I would say after efficiency and effectiveness of state services, add including contract oversight process so we can understand what the oversight was of the agencies on the contract that is let. So it would then read, Commissioner of Administration must report to the legislature by January 15, 2013 and January 15, 2014 on state agency use of eligible contractors under this section and on efficiency and effectiveness of state services, including contract oversight process, as a result of services provided by contractors.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Goodwin. I would certainly agree to including the last part of your amendment, which is including contract oversight. I would speak against deleting the word improvements. I'm a strong believer in continuous improvement, and I believe that striking the word improvement would lead us to a second study to find out what needs to be done. So I speak against, maybe I can amend, I'm not on this committee, I can't amend Senator Goodwin's amendment, but I would speak against deleting the word improvements, but certainly am in favor of the second half of her amendment.
Mr. Chair, to that
Senator
point.
Goodwin.
Thank you. So then what you're saying, Senator Nelson, if you rate it that way, is that we only want to hear about the improvements in efficiency and effectiveness of state services. We don't want to hear if they haven't improved under this process. So that's what you're saying. That's what you're saying. So the agencies would only have to give us a report back that stated any efficiency and effectiveness that came out of this. They wouldn't have to tell us anything if it wasn't effective or it didn't turn out appropriately. They wouldn't have to include that in their report.
Senator Nelson.
Senator Goodwin, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that's not how I understand that at all. If you have something that is working inefficiently or ineffectively and it's not performing the intended service or in the best manner, then certainly this would be called for in the report when it says we want an improvement in efficiency and effectiveness. So I don't mean to be wordsmithing here, but I don't think that I understand what your concern is, and I think this language addresses that in its current form.
Members, I'm going to call on Senate counsel to address that for us. If we strike the two words improvements in, what will that do? What will that require? What will that not require? If you could help us better understand that.
Mr. Chair, members, if you strike the words improvements in, the Commissioner of Administration will then report on state agency use of eligible contractors under this section and on efficiency and effectiveness of state services.
That's what is. That's not what is. What might be is.
As a result of the services provided by the contractors. I think that's a matter of interpretation that I don't know that I can shed any greater light on than
Senator,
members.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Counsel. Senator Perry.
Mr. Chair, and I'm trying to remember how to do this. I'd like to I would agree with Senator Nelson. I think we are starting to do some wordsmithing here, but I'd like to divide this amendment into two parts. The first part being we deal with improvements in, and the second part we would deal with including contract oversight. I believe that was the terminology. Is that the right? Do I have to do an oral amendment to split them, or how do I? Do you want me to do that,
Senator Perry? From what I understand, is the person who offered the amendment is permitted to divide them in two, if that person so chooses.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Goodwin,
I'll do that in honor of Senator Perry, and I'd also like a roll call vote on both of those two. So we would take them separately is what I understand, the first one being the contract oversight, the second one being on those two words, improvements in.
So a roll call has been requested. A roll call is granted. We're going to vote on two separate pieces here. On the first vote, we're going to look at the language after of state services. We're going to insert including contract oversight process as a result of services provided. We're going to vote on that first.
Mr. Chair, can I make a little change to my second division here? Just to
Senator
make it,
Goodwin.
Okay, and what if we said instead, Senator Nelson, on changes in efficiency and effectiveness, would you be more comfortable with that?
Senator Nelson.
No, I'm interested in improvements, which we wouldn't make a change if it weren't an improvement. So I think the issue is continuous improvement, which I'm sure we all strive for.
Senator Carlson.
I'm sorry, Senator Daley, Mr. Chair. We're talking about including this in some other things that we did last year. I would like to know what was the language last year, and maybe we could be consistent with what the language was last year.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Actually, Senator Carlson, I didn't want to belabor this any longer, but I do think that is a very good point. And if maybe admin can speak to the amendment that is before us right now, which is including contract oversight process, if I do think we should find out if I don't see anything damaging in that amendment, but maybe admin does see that it would cause a problem.
Looks like I would maybe like to have Mr. Allen is approaching here.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Kent Allen. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the state. We did have a requirement of a report to the legislature with the bill you passed last year, but it wasn't this specific or prescriptive. My recollection is that it basically was a status report on the development of the master contracts, and we did that in January of this year, as Mr. Yocum mentioned. So I think whatever you would direct us to do next year will be setting new ground as opposed to just repeating what we'd done previously.
Thank you. Thank you. Members, we're going to go back to the second part of Senator Goodwin's now divided oral amendment of state services, including contract oversight process as a result. That's the phrase that we're looking at there in the last sentence. And a roll call has been granted. So if you could proceed with that roll call.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Daley?
Yes.
Senator Hayden?
Present.
Senator Gazelka?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
Yes.
Senator Lilly?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray?
Yes. I don't care.
Senator Wieger?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Hayden?
Yes.
It is unanimous. That part of the divided motion prevails. Okay, now to the second part.
Mr. Chair, deleting the two words.
Senator Goodwin.
And I would like to change that to changes in efficiency and effectiveness rather than just to remove those two words. So remove those two words and then put changes in instead.
So what we're going to vote on, members, here is striking the two words improvements in and inserting the word changes on line 1.15. Senator Carlson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, not to nitpick, but you would leave the word in. All you're doing is changing changes for improvements. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, this sounds like the word is.
So we're going
to. That's right. I agree.
Members, we're going to strike. Senator Goodwin, would you be open to amending your amendment?
Yes, I would.
Amendment?
Fine.
Okay, we're going to change it. We're going to strike improvements in, and we're going to insert the two words. We're just going to strike improvements, and we're going to put the word changes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I just want to reiterate that I would not speak in favor of that amendment. We are interested in continuous improvement.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
I don't know if she withdrew the first, second part in the process of it, but if you would remove the word improvements, which I was reacting to, you are just getting a report on the status, what is, rather than what could be. And changes, I have a hard time kind of grasping what we might learn from that, if it necessarily gives you things that went the other way. But then it would seem to me leaving improvements in and adding another word that said if there were any negative results, that you would be reporting both of those. But just changes doesn't do anything for me. So I would be inclined to agree with you in terms of opposing that amendment as currently on the table.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Members are going to vote on this. A roll call has been requested. A roll call has been granted.
Senator Perry.
No.
Senator Carlson.
No.
Senator Daley.
No.
Senator Hayden.
Yes.
Senator Gazelka.
No.
Senator Goodwin.
Yes.
Senator Lilly.
No.
Senator Olson.
No.
Senator Thompson.
No.
Senator Torres Ray.
Yes.
Senator Wieger.
Yes.
There being four ayes and seven nays, the motion does not prevail. All right, members. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that Senate File 1650, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Next item on the agenda is Senate File 2243, Senator Peterson, Public-Private Partnership Pilot Program and Regulations for Transportation Contracts. This bill came to us from Transportation Committee. Senator Peterson, I believe you have an author's amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. First, I have to say Senator Nelson offered me an ice cream cone if I'd let her go first before this hearing, so I just want to check and see if anybody else in the room wants one before.
That's all right, Senator. Senator Peterson, we're going to move a little rapidly here, move all through right. this. Senator Carlson moves the author's amendment, which is that A1?
A12.
A12 amendment. Would you give us an idea about
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chair and members, this amendment relates specifically to a oversight committee that was addressed in the bill, specifying some members. Also, in the previous hearing in transportation, there was concern about this funding source be applied only to new projects and also not be used for existing infrastructure relating to public and private partnerships. So we added that language as well to get the bill into its current shape. So.
And this came from the reviser, correct?
Yes.
All right. On the A120818 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. To the bill, Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill relates to giving the Minnesota Department of Transportation the permission, basically, to enter into public-private partnerships. Why I believe we think that there's a need for these public-private partnerships relates specifically, in my view, to large, high-cost projects. Right now, it seems to me that we're having trouble getting those projects done. For example, we have a project up nearing my district west of the Twin Cities on I-94 that my hope is would be considered for this type of financing potentially, where we're looking for a high-speed river crossing across the Mississippi River that would connect I-94 and Highway 10, for example. This project is in the neighborhood of $240 or $250 million and quite frankly is very close to not being able to be accomplished simply because of the demands that are on our transportation dollars today. This is a project where much of the environmental work was done already, and the right-of-ways have been purchased and that type of thing. And so the project is started and gone started down the process, but was tabled and shelved because of it. This bill would allow a project like that to potentially move forward and put residents in a situation, the DOT in a situation where we could potentially do projects like that in the future that have not been able to be accomplished.
Senator Peterson, I think I want to direct the attention to the committee. On the amendment portion, what this committee is really looking at is lines 1.3 through 1.10. And I do see that we have a couple of testifiers. Mr. Werke, were you going to testify to that point of the no? Okay. Mr. John Hausladen, I believe, president of the Minnesota Trucking Association, were you going to testify to the Section C 1.3 to 1.10, because that's what we are dealing with today? No. All right. Were there any other testifiers other than those two? All right. Committee, do you have any questions on 1.3 to 1.10? As you can see, it's giving a direction for this advisory and oversight committee. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 2243 as amended be recommended to pass.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Thank you, Senator Peterson. Our amendment does pass.
The amendment?
The bill passes. We already passed the amendment. Excuse me. All right. Thank you very much. Moving along to the next item. is Senate File 2464. We're jumping around on the agenda because of different meetings going on. Senate File 2464, Senator Limmer, Sex Offender Sentencing Grid Modification. This bill came to us from the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. Ms. James, would you direct us to the point of this bill that we need to be looking at?
Mr. Chair and members, this bill directs action by a commission, and the jurisdiction of this committee includes commissions. So all of this bill.
The whole thing. All right. It's not that long, I can see. It's so welcome, Senator Limmer, if you would like to explain this to us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2464 regards the modification of sex offender sentencing grid. The purpose of the bill is to correct a technical error on the sex offender grid of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. The sex offender grid was created originally in 2006 and establishes a presumptive sentences for offenders convicted of criminal sexual conduct and failure to register offenses. When the grid was created, a math error was made, and for this particular crime, the grid is off by 1 month. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission met on Thursday, March 15th, and modified the grid to correct the error. The Commission's enabling legislation requires that any modifications to the grid must be reported to the legislature by January of each year. Since the error was not detected until now, that would mean that the Commission could not report this correction to us until January 2013, and that the corrected grid would not be effective until August of 2013. 2463 would speed up that timeline and permit the Commission to correct the grid and reissue it immediately.
All right. Any questions for Senator Limmer?
2464 or 63? You said 63.
Senate File 2464.
Thank you.
Senator Daley moves that Senate File number 2464 be recommended to pass, and I believe it, just recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Approved. Thank you. Next item on the agenda is House File 2244, Senator Cruz. Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee change into the Legislative Citizen Permanent School Fund Commission. Director of Trust Lands and Mineral Assets Appointment Authorization. The Senate companion to this bill has already traveled through the Education and Environment Committees. Senator Cruz, I believe you have an amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, I do. First of all, thank you for having me today on getting me in. I do have the A1 amendment, if somebody would be so kind as to offer that for me. I do have one quick, very technical incorporation to make, if I may.
So moved.
Senator Carlson moves the A1 amendment.
And, Mr. Chair, before we adopt that, if I could get the committee to turn to page 5. Specifically, I'm looking at line 5.23. If we could get that December 1st of 2014 changed to December 4th of 2013, earlier in the legislation there is a reporting requirement, so all we're simply doing with this amendment is having the commission created so that they can receive that report. We're just moving that a year
earlier.
All right,
thank you very much, Ms. James. Is that December 4th, 2013? Appear to be okay there?
Mr. Chair, yes.
All right, Senator Carlson moves the oral amendment to change line 5.23 from December 1st, 2014 to December 4th, 2013.
You could just, he incorporated that.
Oh, okay. That's all right. We're gonna move that. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. All right, now we're ready to have Ms. James take us to where we need to be for this committee and this bill.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill, looking at the amendment, the A1, section 6, which begins on page 3, line 3.24, establishes a commission. and therefore is in the jurisdiction of this committee. It also establishes a position that's appointed by the governor, and that starts on page 7 in section 8, line 7.16. It's not entirely clear to me where the funds for paying the advisor comes from, but it may be MMB, it may be the administration, both of which are within the jurisdiction, their budgets are within the jurisdiction of this committee.
All right. Senator Cruz, if you could just focus on those two sections and speak to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will do that. Just very quickly so that we get an overall picture here. Essentially, what this amendment will do is it creates a school trust land advisor and the Legislative Commission, the Legislative Citizens Permanent School Fund Commission, to advise the legislature and the Department of Natural Resources on school trust land management. I'm going to do my best to kind of, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, stick to the purview of this committee. So I will again take you to Section 1. This establishes the maximum salary for the new advisor position. Essentially what we've done here is we've included this advisor in the Group 2 salary limits. Some of the equivalent positions now currently held are Commissioner of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, the Commissioner of Bureau of Meditation Services, the Chair of the Metropolitan Council. Those are some of the similar positions where they would be getting paid. Section 3 provides that the forest protection costs will not be certified against the permanent school trust fund. I don't know if that particularly has purview of this committee, but I wanted to just make sure I mentioned that. Section 4 directs the DNR to choose maximizing the long-term revenue when the goals for the school trust lands are in conflict. So I just wanted to mention that. Specifically, Section 6 is where we get real heavy into this committee's jurisdiction. Section 6, Subdivision 1, would essentially create the new Legislative Citizens Permanent School Fund Commission in the legislative branch to replace the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee. And I think that's very important to note. We are not creating a new commission. We are simply redesigning an existing commission.
Senator Cruz, are we increasing the amount of membership or decreasing or keeping it the same?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we may be increasing it slightly, but not by much. This newly created commission has 16 members, and I don't recall right off the top of my head how many the current Legislative Commission has.
Ms. James, would you have any knowledge of that?
Mr. Chair, I do not, but I can count them.
We'll let her do that. All right.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Carlson.
Perhaps Ms. Kelleher would have that answer right off the tip of her tongue.
Welcome, Ms. Kelleher. I see you're here to testify as well. So while Ms. James is checking, maybe we can verify the numbers between the two if you have that.
Mr. Chairman and members, the present commission has legislative members equal to 8 and public members, as the commissioner of the DNR actually submits their application, so he can add to that number. So it's a flexible number now presently. The cost certification piece, if you turn to the very back of your bill, you will find there that cost for the advisor in the committee will be certified against the school trust fund itself, so it will not be coming out of any state budgets.
All right, thank you. Did you have testimony to give?
Mr. Chairman, I'm here to help Senator Cruz move the bill forward.
All right, Senator Cruz, the other section was the Section 8, School Trust Lands Advisor.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will just briefly jump forward to that, go through that. Subdivision 1 basically provides that the school trust lands advisor is appointed by the governor. Subdivision 2 speaks to the qualifications of that appointment. Subdivision 3, as Ms. Kelleher mentioned, speaks to the compensation. Subdivision 4 speaks to the duties, and it provides that the advisor shall advise both the governor, the legislature, and also the newly created commission on managing the school trust lands. And then Subdivision 5 of that strictly speaks, providing that the cost of the school trust lands advisor and the new commission be certified, as Ms. Kelleher mentioned again, against the school trust funds.
All right, any questions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Senator Cruz for offering this legislation. It's really time that we got more money out of the trust lands and into the hands of the corpus of the school trust fund, and I just thank Senator Cruz for really working hard on this, so thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's pertinent to this committee to hear Senator Cruz. The language that we have on page 9 from 918 to 923, we heard this in education, but we didn't dive into administration.
What page
because
are
that
you
was
on?
Not, excuse me, page 9.
There are 9 pages.
There is no 9.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, we did. Are you looking at the A1 amendment?
No. Okay. I'm looking into the full
version.
She had
the bill. She didn't have the amendment. So.
Yeah, I don't have the amendment.
Right.
Sorry.
All right. Further discussion.
Let me look into the new version and see where it is, because the language is that language has not changed. Now I just need to find the renumbering of it.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, if you are referring to the equalizing that we did in the Education Committee.
No.
Okay.
No. I'm looking into the agreement between the commissioner and the Department of Natural DNR, and when they cannot come into agreement that they can hire an outside entity for services. Is that language still in place?
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, there were some significant changes when we went through the Environment Committee. In the original legislation, we had the school trust lands not being under the purview of the Department of Natural Resources. Now they are back under the Department of Natural Resources. So that is how we handle that. That is no longer in the bill.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Further discussion? Senator Wigger?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill as amended. Be recommended to pass.
All right. Senator Lilly?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that you have had an interest in the past in having sunsets on commissions. I don't know exactly if that's in the bill, isn't in the bill, or is appropriate on this particular commission, but just wanted to point that out.
Senator Cruz, did you had to? I know we discussed that. Have you had some thoughts on that,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lilly? This commission is a perpetual commission, and the reason for that is this is needed for continual oversight. The school trust lands is a perpetual fund, and essentially what this legislation is doing is putting a group of professionals together who are experts in all the different areas of that land management to continually make sure that we are getting the maximum value out of those trust lands. So for that reason, there is not a sunset included. This is a perpetual commission.
Senator Lilly.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, is there a reporting back to the legislature then of the results of the commission, annual reporting or some sort of that function?
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lilly, on an annual basis, yes.
Senator Olson.
And Mr. Chair, the income from the permanent school fund is distributed to the schools, and that comes through the Education Committee as a part of their budget every year. And this, it is important to have this advisory capacity that's strengthened in this bill from what the current one is, and I believe will help to assure that we have the expertise and the commitment to be adequate trustees of these lands that many people don't realize were given to the state for the purpose of funding schools and helping with that. And so I think that Senator Cruz has done a very good job of walking this through, and I appreciate the work of Ms. Kelleher as well over the years of elevating this issue and realizing that we have not been paying attention to the return that we're getting on those investments and making decisions that will operate in the best interest of a return that will go to the children and not be just buried in the formula, but also identified so that the schools know what is coming from this fund as well.
Mr. Chairman and
Senator Cruz,
Senator Olson, I would also you know, I would also like to thank Senator Wieger in the room before, you know, before any of us were in tune with this. He was chairing this commission and saying some of the same things that are being said today. It, you know, I truly feel like I've stood on the shoulders of many who have come before me, you know, whether it be Senator Wieger, whether it be Representative Denise Dietrich in the House who's championed this issue, whether it be yourself as well, Chair Olson. So this has been a long fight, and it's good to finally see the finish line here.
All right. Senator Wieger renews his motion that House File 2244, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You know, before I go any farther, I think I need to I'm going to back up here just a moment to put on the record, and I hope I didn't scare them off. But when I asked on Senate File 2243, Senator Peterson's Public-Private Partnership Pilot Program, when I asked Mr. Werke and Mr. John Housladen whether they were testifying to that part of the bill, and they said they weren't, I'm afraid that they thought we weren't going to let them testify at all. And I apologize because that was not my intent, committee members. So I am going to ask them to submit their testimony in writing, if they would, and I apologize for that because, you know, it was just an oversight on my part. I thought that they understood that, so we'll get back to them on that. We're going to move on to the sixth item on the agenda is Senate File 2465, Senator Thompson, Public Employees Retirement Association, PERA, Police and Fire Plan Member Workers Compensation Disability Benefit Provision Modification. This bill was referred to us from the Committee on Jobs and Economic Growth. Senator Thompson, I believe you do have an amendment that you want to start with.
I do, Mr. Chairman, and actually I know you've got a lot of things on the agenda. We may be able to dispense with this fairly quickly. I will make my amendment an oral amendment, and what it would be, Mr. Chairman, is striking and completely eliminating Section 2 as well as Section 3. So in other words, lines 2.13 through 3.2 would be completely eliminated, leaving us with simply Section 1 remaining. And I can give you more detail if you like and lay out more information for members if they'd like it, but suffice it to say that was more or less housekeeping language for the pensions aspect of this legislation. And as it turns out, it has been determined by counsel, Ms. Fontaine, and others, that is not necessary in order to make the bill effective and may not need to be dealt with at all, or if it is, could be dealt with by the pensions committee. And yet the legislation is effective to do what we would like it to do. So with that, Mr. Chairman, since I am a member of the committee, I would move my oral amendment deleting sections 2 or 3 from Senate File 2465.
On the author's oral amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I think that raises a question as to whether or not you still believe that this committee should have jurisdiction over this Senate file. I am more than happy to make my presentation. I have everybody here ready to go, but my understanding, and you and I didn't get the chance to discuss this in detail, but that this committee's jurisdiction was going to deal with the pension aspects of the bill, which have been eliminated. So if you'd like me to move forward, that's fine, but if it is not necessary for this committee to hear it, I will leave that to the discretion of the chairman.
Ms. James, could you advise?
Mr. Chair and members, because this bill deals with the Public Employee Retirement Association retirement plan, I believe it is within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Proceed, Senator.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. This bill was already heard in the Jobs Committee. And what is going on, I'll ask Ms. Wolf to join me at the table. This legislation came about as a result of Ms. Wolf approaching me about a situation that exists with her husband. and her husband, Dan Wolf, was a Minneapolis police officer who unfortunately was severely injured. He was a member of the bomb squad and was injured in a training incident in which an explosive was detonated that caused him brain damage as a result of, I believe, damage to the carotid artery. And as a result of that, which occurred about 7 years ago, he has been unable to work. Now, there's a very strange quirk in the workers' compensation law that, and as it works with the para law, that if an individual such as Mr. Wolf is injured and then is able to return to work but not as a police officer, say that that man or woman were able to return to a desk job, say in human resources or administration or whatever, working as a clerk at a store, whatever the case may be, that individual could work and earn the salary, the paycheck that they get, and in addition to that, receive the para-retirement up to, I believe, 125% of their date of injury wage. But if someone is totally disabled, the way the workers' compensation law works is they receive an average weekly wage, just for easy figuring, let's pick a number and say $700 a week. I'm not saying that's the case here, but let's say, for example, $700 a week in work comp. If they're permanently and totally disabled, but they then receive a disability or retirement benefit, be it through Social Security disability, para, or whatever the case may be, their workers' compensation benefit is reduced dollar for dollar. So let's just say they were to obtain $600 a month in disability benefits or benefits through para, their benefit, work comp benefit, would be reduced by a corresponding amount so that they would only net their $700. Now, that is true for all workers, whether they're public employees, private employees, and the like. But because of the way the pension law works, we end up with this odd and I believe, Mr. Chairman and members, unjust situation in which somebody who is injured less severely and is able to return to gainful employment in a role other than a police officer, they are able to get up to 125% of their wage. If, on the other hand, someone is totally disabled and incapable of returning to sustain gainful employment, I believe is the way the work comp law puts it, they then may end up with significantly less money than they would if they were capable of returning to work. So what this legislation would do, and as you look at Section 1, you'll see the operative changes are on lines 2.6 through 2.12, and it would simply not have the Social Security, that's actually the parlance used in the business. It's not a Social Security. It's an offset for any other source of income, would not apply to para. And it really is no more complicated than that to make sure that the more severely injured police personnel are not actually ending up earning less than those who are able to return to work. So that's the nut of it right there. Getting to this point has been complicated. I've gone through the workers' compensation review process, the commission. I've spoken with folks regarding the retirement fund issues, the para issues. But really now it's down to a fairly simple idea, and that is that we won't penalize an officer for being totally disabled as opposed to being partially disabled so that their work comp benefits won't be diminished as much, if at all, when they are permanently disabled. And with that, we have counsel Ms. Fontaine is here. And if you'd like to briefly hear Ms. Wolf's story, we're happy to present that.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Thompson? All right. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I just want to share for the members that I do serve on the Workers' Comp Advisory Council with Senator Kielash. This issue has come before that council, and members, generally the legislature does not move forward with workers' comp legislation unless it has had the approval of the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, and I want to share with you that this certainly does have the approval This injustice is something that we would all like to find a way to find a solution for, and the Advisory Council does support this legislation and would like to encourage you to support it also. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone here to testify in opposition to this bill? Please state your name, and you may proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Kushner, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, which operates an insurance trust which insures cities for workers' comp coverage. I would first like to say it is not at all an easy thing to oppose a bill that would result in increased benefits for injured police and firefighters. We represent cities. We certainly respect what these people do for a living. However, this bill will result in a very substantial change to how workers' compensation benefits are paid for police officers and firefighters, and we feel it's very important that this committee understand what that change will be. Instead of receiving 66 2/3% of their pre-injury wages tax-free, this will result in employees likely receiving more like 126% of their pre-injury wages tax-free. The current system was carefully crafted and designed to make employees whole and to get them back to work whenever possible. We understand that's not always going to be possible, but whenever possible, the system is designed to get employees back to work. We cannot speak to the specifics of Mr. Wolf's case. That would be inappropriate, and we don't have those facts. But we can say that under current law, an officer in a similar situation would be made financially whole. Again, current law is 2/3 of their salary tax-free and is designed to get them very, very close to their pre-injury wages. In addition, many of these officers will qualify for in-duty disability health insurance benefits. So the city for which they work will be paying the city's same contribution as if they were actively employed by the city. So they will continue to get the same health insurance contribution that they would have gotten if they were actively employed by the city. We have looked at three claims right now that are currently active in our system at the League's Insurance Trust that will be clearly impacted by this bill. The additional cost of those three claims is approximately $3 million, $1 million each. With the strong financial incentive created by this bill, we believe that that number is very, very likely to soar. We should also tell you that we've looked in the last 3 days, we've taken an in-depth look at all of the claims in our system that would be likely to be impacted by this legislation. That is a total of 19 claims. We believe those 19 claims, now we had to do this very, very quickly, but we believe those 19 claims will cost about $24 million. Those are dollars that are paid by cities to the league for their insurance, and it will result in increased workers' comp costs for cities, and that will increase property taxes for our residents. I should also point out that our insurance trust does not include the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Rochester, or any other city not covered by us for work comp. So we aren't even speaking on behalf of the biggest cities here. We are speaking on all of these other cities, and we are already talking about $24 million. It also does not include counties. I believe the counties are here to testify as well. We believe that this bill is being rushed through much too quickly. We need time to study this issue, and we need time to see what the long-term effects will be. I am greatly reminded of a bill that was passed in 1997. That bill required cities to continue to pay health insurance coverage for police and firefighters. The testimony at that time, we went back and we checked the testimony, and it said it will affect a few people per year. By 2003, just 5 years after that bill was passed, it affected 145 active cases because it created a strong financial incentive for these people to be classified in a certain way. It was at that time in 2003 costing close to $1 million per year, despite the testimony that it would not have a large impact. It took us years and many other stakeholders years to get that provision of the law back to its original intent of only impacting a few people. Again, we cannot create this kind of strong incentive. It will affect property taxes eventually. We just don't want to see the same thing happen with this piece of legislation, as well-intentioned as it is, as what happened with that health insurance provision. And that, with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the testifier?
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, the removal of section, the author's amendment removing the workers' comp section is that included in terms of the impact that in your testimony?
Yes.
Is it as the bill was came to us or as it's amended that you're addressing?
Ms. Kushner.
Mr. Chair, that has no impact on my testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator Daley?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Senator Thompson. I think his credentials as a kind of a conservative legislator fairly intact. I mean, I think he's a pretty conservative kind of guy. I don't think that's in dispute here. Is it your intention to cover one case, this particular case that was brought to you, or is it an entire new class? Is there maybe a way that we could cover with this legislation more specifically to this one case, or is it your intention to cover perhaps more than just the one that was brought to you?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Daley,
Senator Thompson.
I frankly believe it is not good policy making generally to target statewide legislation at an individual or group of individuals. So I believe that this is an injustice in the system regardless of who or how many it impacts. That being said, this legislation has been percolating for a little while in terms of being discussed in front of the Work Comp Commission, as Senator Lilly said, and the like. But it is not a simple piece of legislation. I am sympathetic to the concerns that other stakeholders have. I was not aware that it could potentially impact this many claims. I don't believe Ms. Wolf was aware of that. Those, I think, are things that need to be discussed and taken into consideration. And it was first raised to me at the initial hearing in the Jobs Committee that there could be such broad application that it may become impractical. It's nobody's intent here to drive into question the integrity of these self-insured funds or however they're funded for work comp. I do understand a little bit about that, having been a work comp defense lawyer for 6 years. So the answer is I don't think it's right to propose legislation specifically for an individual, but I also certainly am sympathetic to the idea that we can't allow a piece of legislation forward that is going to call into question the fiscal integrity of these various funds, and I'm more than willing to have conversations about that moving forward.
All right. Thank you very much. I believe we have one more testifier. Please state
Mr.
your
Chairman,
name
members,
proceed.
I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that represents 13 of the larger counties here, and I also appear in opposition to this bill. I do want to make it clear that if money was no object, that we would have no qualms about honoring the service that Ms. Wolf's husband gave to the city of Minneapolis, as well as the other individuals affected this. But frankly, money is a consideration. You, city councils, county boards, all have to, I think, balance the need to provide reasonable compensation to these individuals for their disabilities with the cost to the taxpayer. I think this has been somewhat mischaracterized as only being an issue for PERA, police and fire disability recipients. Well, the bill, as it's stated right now, only affects the PERA totally and permanently disabled police and fire disability benefits. The current workers' compensation offset affects everybody who receives a governmental disability pension. And consequently, you're going to get into a situation that I've seen time and again in my 30 years associated with this institution, where somebody is going to come next year and say, me too, year after that, me too, year after that, me too. The document that I had passed out is a provision in also the disability law that gives Mr. Wolf and several other individuals their current disability pensions. This was amended into the law in 2007, and at the time it was characterized as just affecting one individual. Since that time, it's obviously been extended to six more, and it will grow in the future. Basically, the benefit that was given was that instead of the disability pension cutting off at normal retirement age, which would be 55 for police and fire disability recipient, they continue to get that pension for life. In addition, as was mentioned by my colleague from the cities, then they automatically qualify for the employer paying their share of the health insurance premium that they received as an employee for, in this instance, for life. For other disability recipients, that again cuts off when they reach normal retirement age at 55. So there's already substantial benefit provided for at least some of these individuals. They are receiving compensation after taxes greater than what they received when they were fully employed. Was identified by Ms. Kirshner for just the seven recipients that we know of. At a minimum, it will cost $5 million over the lifetime of those individuals in additional premiums. And again, because of this log rolling phenomena that I discuss, you know, some of the other police and fire disability beneficiaries who don't meet the total and permanent requirement conceivably could be back next year. The state patrol plan disability recipients could be back next year. PERA general plan. And then finally, you could get to every disability recipient. At that point, you would be costing employers throughout Minnesota tens, likely hundreds of millions of dollars without this offset. With that, Mr. Chairman, members, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Thompson, did this go before the Pension Commission?
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin, it did not, and the reason that it did not is after I spoke with Senator Rosen about that today, and she had talked with Mary Vanek earlier, and it was concluded that with the removal of Sections 2 and 3, there are no pension-related elements to this bill anymore. It is purely a work comp bill, and so it was vetted by Senator Rosen and concluded that there was no need to go before the Pension Commission.
Senator Goodwin.
And are people that are permanently and totally disabled eligible for Social Security as I didn't think so. Social Security disability benefits? No.
Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I don't know, so I'm going to allow Ms. Wolf to comment on that if it please the chair, because she's been living this for about 7 years.
Please state your name and you may answer.
Wendy Wolf. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, if a police officer does not do any outside employment, they don't pay into the Social Security system. So in my husband's case, he had been only doing his police work for the past however many years they look back, and so he was not eligible for Social Security.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, I first off put my glasses on so I could read my writing. I move that Senate File 2465 as amended be recommended to pass.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It prevails. Senator Wieger, I think we're going to take yours. The next item is on the agenda is Senate File 2421. Senator Wieger, Grants Management Provisions Modifications, Film Production Jobs Program Oversight Authority Transfer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 2421 is an initiative from the Department of Administration. There's just three provisions. Two relate to grants management and one, the Film Production Jobs Program. On the latter point, it would transfer the Film Production Jobs Program from Explore Minnesota to the Commissioner of Administration. The former agency is in agreement with this change, and to address the grant changes, I have Alyssa Haugen from the Director of the Office of Grants Management.
Well, thank you. And before we get to your testifier, I think we should ask Senator Cohn if he's okay with this one.
You know, Mr. Chairman, after getting beat up by members of your caucus and the Rules Committee for the last 2 hours,
You're pretty quiet. Well, it's something to do with films, and I know we worked hard on making sure the Snowgate was in that bill. But
I believe this is okay.
All right. Sounds good. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alyssa Haugen, Director of the Office of Grants Management, which is housed in the Department of Administration. As Senator Wieger said, the first two items add references to statutes that already exist. What we're looking to do with this bill is place them in the grants management statute, so when grants management experts are looking for their citations for effective dates and for the ability to certify funds, everything will be housed in 16B98 for grants. And in regards to the film production program, last year, as part of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, admin received the appropriation to run Snowbait. But as the statute currently reads, admin would need to approve those grant expenditures and seek additional approval from Minnesota Tourism. This change will remove that redundancy and just allow admin to approve those expenditures. So that's all we're seeking to do with this. If you have any additional questions, I'd be happy to address those at this time.
Any further questions? Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that Senate File 2421 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you.
Bill prevails.
Thank you.
We're going to go back to now the what is called the eighth item on the agenda, Senate File 2090. Senator Thompson, State Procurement of Outside Contract Restrictions Removal and Repeal. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This piece of legislation is really fairly simple. As you look at the Senate File 2090, you will see that in Section 1 there is an opportunity for professional or technical services contracts that aren't done on kind of a statewide large procurement contract basis to go outside and get these services performed by outside entities. Currently, under state law, one of the things that the agency must show in order to be able to do this is that down there in line 1.20 and on, no current state employee is able and available to perform the services called for by the contract. Then if you go over to the next page, starting at line 210, there we are just 210 through 217, eliminating language that pertains to a state employee doing this kind of work. Then if we go down to section 2, once again, we're talking about a service contract and a commissioner having the opportunity to go out and get the services done by an outside contractor and not having to demonstrate that there is no state employee able to perform that task. And finally, there's then a provision dealing with employees that have been laid off or not currently working for the state, but that had worked for the state, I believe, and I can't see the language right in front of me, I believe it was within the last 4 years. So the bottom line is the 30,000-foot view of this is that we want agencies to be able to go out and contract for services. And one would presume that if they had the resources and the ability to do it in-house, they wouldn't be out there procuring it, but sometimes they may want to. And we also believe that they shouldn't have to be under an obligation to bring employees back. And so that really is simply what this bill is about, Mr. Chairman and members, is the ability to go out and independent contract for services without having to demonstrate that there's no state employee that can do it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Thompson, I helped you out on that last one, but this one I'm not. I think a little history is important here that revolves around this language.
Well, one for two isn't bad, Senator Goodwin.
Okay. Okay. So what this language that requires a current state employee to, able and available to perform services has been greatly cut down. In the past, they used to have to post the jobs and make sure that there were current, and they had to leave it open for a certain amount of days, and all of that language has been extracted in the last few years. So now all the only thing that they're supposed to do is to check to see if a current state employee is able and available, both able and available. So if they know how to do the work, and if they're available to do the work, their agency can do without them for a while. Then they have to just make sure that doesn't give a timeline of when, how long they have to spend or any of that. The reason for that was because we found a number of contracts that were let out. You need to really take a look at the system because there's a lot of stuff going wrong in our contracting system and almost no oversight. So people could give contracts to their buddies or their kid or whoever, and we were finding that was a lot more expensive for the state to go out and do these contracts because oftentimes there's a middleman, the owner of a certain firm or whatever. So we put that in there to save money, to make sure that if we had somebody available, let them do the work. And we've tried in the past to get in language that asks for a cost-benefit analysis so that if an employee wants to do the work and a contractor wants to do the work, then they have a chance to bid on it and find out what the cost is. This other part of your bill, 2.10 to 2.14, this is really important language to keep in current law because it's in the event the results of contract work will be carried out or continued by state employees upon completion of the contract. The contractor is required to include state employees in development and training to the extent necessary. Now, the reason for that language in current law is because what has often happened in the past, and particularly with IT projects, is that they have hired a contractor to do the project, and then, lo and behold, whatever program they develop, they are the only ones that can run the program. So they haven't taught the state employees how to do that along the way. So then we have a program that a particular contractor has developed to keep ongoing work with the state of Minnesota when ongoing work would not be needed. That is extremely important. So the first thing I would do is say offer an oral amendment to take off 2.10 to 2.14. I'd like a roll call on that.
Ms. James.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Goodwin moves to reinstate lines 2.10 through 2.14.
Any discussion, Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, if you just allow me a moment to reread the paragraph and make sure I understand what Senator Goodwin is suggesting that is removed. Well, Mr. Chairman, I would speak against the amendment because it would, in fact, undercut a lot of the intent of the bill. The idea is that contractors would be able to do these things on their own. This sort of presumes this language from 2.1 to 2.14, if I understand it correctly, more or less presumes that the state employees would be a part of working, even though the decision That essentially is almost just follows from the provision that says state employees don't have to be brought in. So it to me doesn't make sense to pull that one part out. So I would ask the members to vote against Senator Goodwin's amendment.
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, it's a big mistake, Senator Thompson, and it's a big mistake for the cost of projects. And if you look at a few of the projects with Health and Human Services, you'll see what I mean. There were hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that were spent on programs that were supposed to be able to collect data and have it all in one place and so forth. The contractors kept getting amendments over and over again for ongoing work, addendums they call them, or and what happened is the state just kept spending money and throwing it in a hole because this company really never got it right. And another company that they gave another project to, those two were supposed to work together, and they didn't. But we were stuck with those contracts. And the work that did get done on those contracts had to be done by the department. The programs that they were developing, there had to be staff involved in those programs. And they weren't trained to work with the program. So there was a big mess after that. So what you're doing here is saying it's really, really not preventing anybody. That section is not preventing anybody from getting a contract with the state. It's just saying if you've got a job that state employees are going to have to continue to operate, that you train those employees to do that. So you don't take off with your $2 million or $10 million or $40 million project that you did and leave nobody that knows how to operate the program. And that has happened in several agencies. And then, of course, then you're constantly dependent on the same contractor because usually this program they develop, if it's an IT program or whatever, there isn't anybody that can operate the program either out there, another private company. So this is a huge mistake to put that in.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin. I think maybe we're losing sight of the fact that we're removing simply one requirement here, and that is the requirement to determine that there are no state employees that can do a task. All of the other protections that exist to try to prevent the kinds of problems that Senator Goodwin alludes to are still here. They can't just give it to a relative or a friend or something like that. They have to demonstrate, if you look here in lines 1.11 through 1.18, a description of how the proposed contract or amendment is necessary and reasonable to advance the mission, description of the agency's plan, et cetera, description of the performance measures or other tools. So we're not removing any of the requirements relating to making sure that vendors or contractors can do the job properly and efficiently. That's not what we're doing.
All right, thank you. I know we have a couple of testifiers. If there are testifiers here, please come forward at this time. So I'd like to hear your testimony. Please state your name and you may proceed. And we are on a time schedule here, so I know how you can get your point across.
Mr. Chair and members, Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, and Mr. Chair, I promise to keep my comments brief. Let me first start by stating this is a jobs-killing bill for the state of Minnesota at a time when we should be working towards creating jobs. Minnesota does, and we've heard it repeatedly in this committee, have the 10th leanest state workforce in the country, and the Economic Policy Institute did a study in 2009 that determined for every 100 public sector jobs that are cut, you're going to cut 30 jobs in the private sector as well. Minnesota has 8 state workers per 1,000 residents, ranking 37th out of 50 states. And in Minnesota, only 8% of state tax dollars go to state compensation. And I'm not here to just provide you all this data for no reason, Mr. Chair. Not only does this bill open the floodgates to eliminate jobs, it jeopardizes the state's ability to successfully recruit employees at a time when retirements have increased. This bill removes employee job security and allows anyone in a managerial position to outsource work, which may create more conflicts of interest, as Senator Goodwin alluded to, and violations of the state code of ethics. Mr. Chairman, while I was sitting in back today admiring your work, I jotted down a few job classes that our members do for all of you. They inspect your food. They take care of your veterans in the veterans' homes. They supervise offenders and sex offenders in our community where you live. They inspect and enforce OSHA regulations to make your workplace safe. They provide clean lakes, take care of our animals at the zoo, manage the state forestry and state parks. and they're forensic scientists and a critical element to the criminal justice system. Mr. Chair, this is a lean workforce that we already have in the state of Minnesota. These are not jobs that you open the yellow pages to and replace. We don't need to entrust this to people who are not trained or regulated in the state of Minnesota. This is what's at risk with a high potential to pay a lot of money when you lay off state employees. And Mr. Chair, part of this bill that's being eliminated or attempted to be eliminated here today is a bill that was passed by Senator Betzold and Representative Steve Simon about 6 years ago that was signed into law by Governor Pawlenty. This is a large waste of government. And as Senator Goodwin just got done alluding to, not training employees and allowing the state on line 1.2, when there's people already there performing work, not to do that work while you bring in additional employees from the private sector to do work, is wasting taxpayer dollars. It's wasting government money and is not reform at all. Mr. Chair and members, I urge you to vote no on this.
Thank you. Further testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blout, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5 in Minnesota. We represent 43,000 state, county, and local government employees. With all due respect to Senator Thompson, this is not a simple bill. The crafting of this language and the work that's gone into this with Senator Goodwin over the years has put forth a process that all of the legislature should take seriously. The governing body is the state legislature. The public employees provide the services. It's not a simple process. As Mr. Kajewski stated, those are some of the services. We can add on the services that our folks provide as well. And I'll just highlight, because we happen to have a couple of our COs here today, correctional officers. And I don't think that if you went up to them and asked them if this was a simple provision, I don't think they'd agree with you. And I don't think the other 43,000 public employees would agree either. Granted, this affects the state public employees, but it also has an impact. If you're impacting them, you're also impacting our local government employees as well. And I urge you today to defeat this proposal and to take seriously the work that needs to be done by our public employees and provide them the support rather than try to eliminate them. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
We have another testifier.
Mr. Chair, are we still on the amendment?
Yes, we are. Okay. Please state your name.
Good afternoon. My name is Kurt Yoakum. I'm the legislative liaison with the Department of Administration. I'll keep my comments brief. It was actually to the overall bill. I'm just here to express our opposition to the legislation. And just to make two brief points, we don't believe that repealing the statutes commonly known as able and available in 16C.08 and 16C.09, we do not believe that those prevent the state and state agencies from seeking innovative or best value services for the state of Minnesota. I think earlier today in the committee, we've already had a great discussion about data analytics and the work that state agencies have done on reaching out to the private sector and bringing in talented private sector to complement the already great work being done regularly on by state employees. I would also highlight, as I think this committee has talked about quite a bit, some of the partnerships that Department of Administration and several other state agencies have developed with entities such as General Mills for the Lean Continuous Improvement Program, which also was referenced today. Just to highlight some of those, we are regularly working with the private sector to complement the work of state agencies, and so we do not feel that the able and available statutes have been a hindrance to that. And the only other thing I would add is the good work that done in those fields that I just mentioned is predicated on a solid, fundamental working relationship with the state employees that we have in our agencies. Right now, I think if you look at the last year, what the state employees have done in the face of the government shutdown, still keeping things operated or bringing back after the shutdown, a very large-scale IT consolidation, and also the work on a state's massive new accounting and procurement computer system that's impacting and taking resources from every every state agency. I mean that in a very positive way. We do have a fear that legislation such as this may have a chilling effect on that positive relationship that we have developed with our employees who we trust to carry out these provisions. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and gladly stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Further testimony?
Senator.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and I also lead the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. Mine is more a point of information where there are sections of the bill that they deal with in Section 16 or Chapter 16 and Chapter 43, and that I believe there's a document that the Department of Administration has when Senator Baldwin was talking about the accountability that is addressed in that department as far as use of outside contractors, and if that could apply also to the outside contractors, I think your issue would be addressed. So, like I say, it's kind of like the department information on conflict of interest and ethics kind of overlaps that in Chapter 15 in another bill.
All right, thank you. Further discussion? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have said this before, Senator Thompson, and I'm going to say it again because I think it's relevant. I did work for the state of Minnesota for many, many years, and I worked with many consultants that were hired to do trainings, to do all kinds of jobs. And I think what the administration just said is very important, and I hope that you reflect on that. This will have a very negative effect, in my view, in terms of creating trust and building relationships between many of the contractors that are being hired by the state and state employees. When we, by legislation, simply say, you know, you're just not going to work on this together. And that's what this legislation said, you know. Contractors, state employees cannot work, perform the services called by the contract. This is very problematic for the state of Minnesota, and I think that we need to be doing the opposite. And I'm going to repeat this, Senator Thompson. I do believe that the message about efficiency and trying to figure out a way to make government more efficient is more relevant than ever. I think that that argument is valid. I think that that argument carries a lot really of relevance today because we have a larger government that does more things with less resources. So efficiency is imperative. But this blanket approach, you know, that we're really directing these agencies to do business in a way that is ineffective is just really inappropriate. I can't support this. We need to really figure out ways to create efficiency in a more thoughtful way. So I wish that there was a better way to deliver on that message. That I think the message is appropriate. I think again and again the message is appropriate about government efficiency. I really believe in that. These tools are really not very good. They do not work. They do not work, Senator. Believe me, I worked in the state for many, many years. These tools do not work.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. A number of concerns have been raised, and I'll try to briefly address the ones that I jotted down. First off, I guess I'll start with Senator Torres Ray's point. This is not preventing anyone in an agency from using employees if they choose to. It is simply directing that it is not a hurdle they must get over. They don't have to prove that no current state employee is able and available to perform the services called for by the contract. They are more than free to use those folks if they are available, and my assumption is that they would be. That's generally how industry does it. They'll use their internal resources if they can and want to. And not if it doesn't seem to be the best situation under the circumstances. I would point out that in terms of loss of jobs, if the work gets outsourced, there are private jobs potentially created, and that's a good thing. I think that creating some ability for the state and agencies to be nimble in making these decisions and not be burdened by requirements, but having just the opportunity to choose to use internal staff if they want to, but not being forced to if they feel it would be better not to. I found it interesting that the Department of Administration says, well, we don't want this because it interferes with our ability to do work the way we want to. No, it doesn't. They can keep doing business exactly the way they're doing it now. They just don't have to. By statute, they have that choice. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file 2090.
Excuse me. We're going to amendment.
Secretary, I apologize.
Secretary is going to take the roll on the Goodwin oral amendment.
Senator Perry.
No.
Senator Carlson.
No.
Senator Cohen.
Yes.
Senator Daley.
No.
Senator Gazelka.
Nope.
Senator Goodwin.
Yes.
Senator Lilly.
No.
Senator Thompson.
No.
Senator Torres Wright.
Yes.
Senator Wieger.
Yes.
And a vote of 6 no's and 4 yeas, the amendment does not prevail. Senator Thompson.
Got a little ahead of myself. Now, I would ask that Senate File 2090 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor signify.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on that.
Roll call has been granted. Secretary will take the roll.
Senator Perry.
Yes.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Daley.
Yes.
Senator Gazelka.
Yes.
Senator Goodwin.
No.
Senator Lilly.
Yes.
Senator Thompson.
Yes.
Senator Torres Wright.
No.
Senator Wieger.
No.
There being 6 yeses and 3 noes, the bill does pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Members, we will not be meeting tonight, but I believe we are meeting Friday morning at 8 a.m., and I believe that room will be 112. Room 112, Friday morning, 8 a.m. We have bills to move, so hopefully we'll have everyone there bright and early. Have a good evening. Being there's no further business before this committee, we are adjourned.